inspiration. He said, verse 1, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. And God inspired Moses to speak this to the new generation because they were going to be meeting forces that were mightier and stronger than them. Horses and chariots, cavalry. And the Israelites didn't have any of that. They were just going to be foot soldiers, and they weren't battle-hardened soldiers like the Canaanites were. So God was encouraging them through Moses, don't be afraid of those mighty forces. And the reason why, verse number 4, for the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. And what we're going to be reading in especially chapter 10 and 11 today is the fulfillment of that scripture in Deuteronomy. But before we get to that, let's do a brief review from the last time. We covered chapter 7 through 9 in the Bible study last month. And to briefly review chapter 7, that dealt with Achan's sin and the defeat at Ai. And you remember that Israel, God caused them to win the battle at Jericho. The walls of Jericho fell. But there was an individual named Achan that took treasures from Jericho that should have been devoted to God. And because he did that, that was a sin. And Israel, the next battle that they came against, the next city, was Ai. And they were defeated in that first battle because of Achan's sin. So through a process of elimination that they went through, looking at the tribes and the families, etc., they finally eliminated and brought down to the fact that it was this Ai, this individual, who had taken these treasures that should have been devoted to God, and he was put to death. That brings us to chapter 8. Again, we're briefly reviewing from the last time. Because this sin had been dealt with, and Ai was put to death, Israel went against Ai again and conquered it. And the key to that particular victory was decoy and ambush. They used a strategy against these Canaanites, and it was a key to the victory. And finally, Joshua stretched out his spear toward Ai, and God took charge of the battle, and they won. Then in the last part of chapter 7, the scene actually shifted to 25 miles north of where they were at, and they did the covenant ceremony that was held at Mount Ebal. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 27, in Moses' sermon to the new generation, he said, when they get to the promised land, they are to do the covenant ceremony, and they fulfilled that here in chapter 8. And they also did the blessings and cursing ceremony, which was held at Mount Ebal in Mount Gerizim. And then finally, we covered chapter 9 in the last Bible study. There was a city that wasn't very far away from Ai, where they had just won a battle. The city was called Gibeon, and they wanted to make a peace treaty with Israel. Gibeon sent representatives portraying that they had come from a faraway distance outside of the promised land. And remember in Deuteronomy, God said that if any nation outside of the promised land, you know, let's say way far out, would come and seek peace with Israel, that they were to make a peace treaty with them. So these Gibeonites portrayed that they had come from a far country. They had worn out shoes, they had moldy bread and et cetera to try to prove that they were from a far country. Israel made a mistake in that they did not ask for more proof from them as to who they were. And the other vital mistake, they did not seek God's counsel to find out, were they really from a faraway country? So Israel entered into a peace treaty with Gibeon, although they were to be servants to Israel. And that peace treaty with Gibeon sets the stage for what we're going to read in chapter 10. So we'll begin the study in chapter 10 now. Chapter 10 basically is concerning the conquest of Jerusalem and a coalition of southern Canaanite cities. Chapter 10 is concerning that, and it has to do with this peace treaty that Gibeon made, and other Canaanites were calling them traitors for doing that. Chapter 10, verse number 1. Now it came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, and you notice the name Jerusalem here, this is the first time we run across the name Jerusalem in the Bible. And it's here in chapter 10, verse number 1. Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. So they were accusing Gibeon of being traitors to all the rest of the Canaanites. And they're actually in cahoots with the Israelites. Continuing on, verse number 2, that they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. So the king of Jerusalem realized that Ai was a mighty city, and it had fallen. Gibeon was a mighty city, and they had made peace with Israel. And so now they were worried, and what he's going to do is form a coalition of other Canaanite cities to go against Gibeon. But backtracking a little bit, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't have that up there on the screen for you, sorry. Okay, continuing, going back here to verse number 1, we see this phrase, King of Jerusalem. And by this time in the 14th century B.C., Jerusalem had become an important city. And its king was very, very powerful. He's going to be able to unite other Canaanite cities, as we're going to see here shortly. So Gibeon had made peace with the Israelites. They considered them traitors, and they had deserted to the enemy, is the way that the king of Jerusalem was looking at them. This name Jerusalem, as I mentioned, this is the first time you see it in the Bible, the first time it appears in the Bible. But Jerusalem, when we consider it throughout the scriptures, has great, great significance. It has physical significance because God chose Jerusalem for the location of the temple. Eventually Solomon, King Solomon, would build the temple in Jerusalem. So physical significance. It also has spiritual importance and significance because Jerusalem, or Zion, as it's called, symbolizes the church. And then finally, Jerusalem has prophetic significance because we know from prophecy that in the future, Jesus Christ is going to return to Jerusalem and rule all nations. So much significance with Jerusalem. But in this particular instance, in the 14th century AD, it was a Canaanite city, and Israel is going to battle them. Okay, continuing on now, verses 3 through 5. This king of Jerusalem is going to form an alliance, a coalition to punish these Gibeonites who made peace with Israel. Verse number 3. Therefore, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoam, king of Hebron, that's a Canaanite city, Piram, king of Jarmuth, a second Canaanite city, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. So there's four Canaanite kingdoms that are going to unite with Jerusalem in a coalition. And the king of Jerusalem, in verse 4, said, "Come up to me and help me, that we may attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and the children of Israel." So they're going to make a coalition of five Canaanite kingdoms to punish Gibeon. Verse 5, "Therefore the five kings of the Amorites," another name for the Canaanites, "the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they and all their armies, encamped before Gibeon and made war against it." So this coalition of five Canaanite cities came up against Gibeon on the battlefield to make war. So what we have, again, is four other Canaanite kingdoms uniting with Jerusalem king of Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon that have formed this coalition. Now, just to give you an idea, all of these were in the general area of Jerusalem in their location. Hebron was approximately 19 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Jarmuth was 16 miles west of Jerusalem. Lachish, 30 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And Eglon was the farthest away, 35 miles southwest of Jerusalem. So they were all within a general area of Jerusalem and formed this coalition. And as we see here in the last part of verse number 5, they camped before Gibeon and made war against it. These five kings and their armies attack Gibeon. Then the next section that we come to, beginning in verse number 6, Gibeon, who realizes these five Canaanite kings have come against them with all their armies, they're going to make good. They want Israel to make good with their treaty. They ask for help from Israel. Verse number 6, and the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the mountains have gathered together against us." Now, this city of Gibeon, they have their own forces. And most likely they had their cavalry, they had their chariots, etc. But they want Israel to come and help them now. Verse number 7. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal. Let me point out that word ascended, you can read over that very quickly and not realize how they're ascending. They have to go up 4,000 feet, Joshua and his armies, ascending mountains to go up to where Gibeon is. So, and they're on foot. So that's quite a journey to go up 4,000 feet. Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. Then notice this in verse number 8. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand before you." The fulfillment of what we read earlier, Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 1 and 4, God said, "I am going to fight for you. Don't worry about these five Canaanite cities. They're in my hands." Verse number 9, continuing on, Joshua therefore came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. Okay, I already mentioned that they had to ascend 4,000 feet, but they're also marching all night, making this ascent. And this was a distance of about 35 kilometers or 20 miles that they're going up all night long. So you can imagine by the time that they climbed all of that all night, they were tired, Joshua and his men. Didn't matter. Notice verse number 10. So the Lord routed them before Israel, killed them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, chased them along the road that goes to Beth Horon, and struck them down as far as Azekah and Makkedah. So, again, fulfillment of Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 1 and 4, that God would fight for Israel. Even though they had made a 4,000-foot journey all night long, and most likely were tired. Verse number 11. And it happened as they fled, these five kingdoms, their armies, as they fled before Israel and were on the descent of Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down large hailstones from heaven, or from the clouds, on them as far as Azekah, and they died. And then the last part of verse number 11 explains, there were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword. So God performed a miracle, raining down this hail upon these armies as they were trying to flee down the mountainside. We're going to see, though, however, that some of these armies, especially their kings, do escape the hailstones. Now, this particular battle against this coalition was not so much about saving the Gibeonites coming to their rescue, but it was actually military strategy. Because had Israel gone against each city one at a time, you know, each one of those nations in the coalition, it would have taken more time and more effort doing it. Here they were all kind of combined together, And God destroyed most of their armies all in one blast. So again, it was a fulfillment of God being with them, the Canaanites that were united together. Continuing on now, because Joshua and his men had made this 4,000 feet ascent all night long, their men were tired. And some of the Canaanite forces did escape. We're going to see that as we read on. And they escaped the hailstones as well. So Joshua realizes he needs more time. They're exhausted. The Canaanites are fleeing downhill. So he's going to pray to God for another miracle. And that's the next section. Verse number 12. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord. He's doing this in the form of a prayer. In the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and said in the sight of Israel, in other words, all of Israel heard his prayer, sun stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon. So he prays to God for a miracle to happen, and it does. Verse 13. So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. Verse 14, and there has been no day like that, before it or after it, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Verse 15, then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal. So we see in this section, not only is God fighting for Israel, but he's answering Joshua's prayer for a miracle to happen. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. It says, there was a halting of the sun. The Hebrew term is amad, which means to stand still or to stop, a delaying in the sun going down. And this allowed Israel to complete its campaign against the fleeing enemy. It was a miracle. Some people ask what this book of Jasher was that's mentioned here in verse number 13. It's only mentioned again in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 18. An expositor's comments and says, this bit of Hebrew literature has been lost. Perhaps it was a collection of heroic songs. So it was something that was written in the ancient times, but it has become lost and no one knows what happened to it. Okay, before we continue on now, let me comment here about this miracle that took place. Because questions come up as, well, what exactly happened? And the bottom line is, we don't know exactly what happened. And the commentators are all over about what happened. Some say, well, perhaps it was an eclipse that God caused. Some say that the sun and moon stayed where they were at until the battle ended. Some say that the rotation of the earth came to a halt. And some will say that the rotation of the earth slowed down so that it made one rotation in 48 hours instead of 24 hours. Now, again, we don't know exactly what it was. The bottom line is, God performed a miracle and he answered Joshua's prayer. And Israel was able to continue on in the battle and defeat most of their enemies. And as we continue on, we see how they dealt with those enemies that had escaped the hailstones. And the first ones to be dealt with were the five Amorite kings, the five Canaanite kings of the coalition who were executed. And you know how it is. You see it in the movies, the generals, the kings, they always stand up on a hill watching the battle as the forces are fighting down below. And the first ones to escape are usually the top ones. And that's true here in this particular incident. The five Amorite kings escaped the hailstones in the battle as well. Verse 16. But these five kings had fled. They got away from the hailstones, etc., and hid themselves in a cave at Makkedah. So they found a cave to hide in. Verse 17, and it was told Joshua, saying, the five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah. Notice Joshua's response, verse 18. So Joshua said, roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and set men by it to guard them. So they rolled stones in front of the cave so they couldn't get out, made them prisoners, and set guards at the front of the cave. Verse 19. And do not stay there yourselves, but pursue your enemies, because there were still some that were escaping, and attack their rear guard. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for the Lord your God has delivered them into your hand. Verse 20, then it happened while Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter, till they had finished, that those who had escaped entered fortified cities. So even though they were winning the battle in general, there were still a few that had escaped to their prospective cities. And let me point out, too, that even though these Canaanite kings had set their majority of the forces out into battle at Gibeon, they still left some there to guard their cities. And this is, I'm pointing this out because Israel's still going to have to take those cities and come against those forces that were left there. Verse 21. And all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makkedah in peace. And no one moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. So what we have here then is that Israel set out to try to finish off the rest of the armies, the ones that had survived the hailstones. But they didn't attack the rest of the cities yet, because they wanted to keep them intact for future use by Israel. Going back to verse 21, this phrase moved his tongue against Israel. No one moved their tongue against Israel. The Nelson Study Bible points out that means to criticize or slander against Israel because of what had taken place. So the kings are captured. They're in a cave, or their stones are rolled against them in the cave, and now they're going to be dealt with. Verse 22. Then Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave. Bring out those five kings to me from the cave." And they did so, brought out those five kings to him from the cave. The king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And so these were five Amorite kings, Canaanite kings, the kings of these cities, and they're going to be dealt with now after they're brought out from their hiding place. So it was, verse 24, when they brought out these kings to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the captains, the men of war who went with him, "Come near, put your feet on their necks of these kings." And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. And that was an ancient symbol of defeat of a king from another nation. And that's why they put their feet on their necks. In fact, I've got a comment here from Bible Knowledge Commentary about this phrase, put their feet on their necks. Bible Knowledge Commentary says, following an Eastern custom of conquerors, that's what they did. Joshua instructed his field commanders to put their feet on the king's neck. This was a symbol of the complete subjugation of the defeated enemy. Then after they had done this, as a symbol of defeat, they actually execute these five kings. Verse 25 through 27. Verse 25. Then Joshua said to them, "Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage. For the Lord will thus do to all your enemies against whom you fight." You know, they're going to be defeated as well, just like these five kings. Verse 26. And afterward, Joshua struck them and killed them. Hang them on five trees, and they were hanging on the trees until evening. Now, I mentioned this before in previous Bible studies, that this wasn't the type of hanging like we see in our Western movies where they hung them by the neck. They actually hung them probably by their arms, and this was a symbol that they were accursed by God in doing this. And so most likely they stoned them first, killed them, and then hung them up to show that they'd been defeated and they were cursed by God. But it wasn't the type of hanging by neck. Verse 27, And so it was at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded. They took them down from the trees, cast them into a cave where they had been hidden, laid large stones against the cave's mouth, which remains until this day. So they made graves for them in these caves. And this, they took them down before sunset because they didn't want the land to be defiled. Going back to Deuteronomy chapter 21 through 23. And then the stones were rolled in front of the cave's mouth as a reminder of part of the conquest that had taken place. So these five kings, they've been dealt with. But now some of those cities that they had come from and their forces, Joshua and Israel has to take them, along with other cities in the southern part of Canaan. And that brings us to this next section, verses 28 through 39, what most commentators call the southern campaign in the southern part of Canaan. And Israel is going to be dealing with the key military centers in the southern part of Canaan. And seven Canaanite cities are going to be mentioned in this particular section. There were other cities in Canaan, and especially in the south, but these are the key military installations that have to be dealt with. And what we're going to talk about here in this section is a summary of capturing the major cities in the southern part of Canaan. Some of them were the anti-Gibeon coalition that we just talked about. Many of their soldiers had been killed. Some of them escaped to the cities. Now these cities are going to be taken because they still had defenders. Okay, verse 28. On that day, Joshua took Makkedah, which was a key military center, struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, all the people who were in it. He let none remain. He also did it to the king of Makkedah as he had done to the king of Jericho. Verse 29, then Joshua passed from Makkedah and all Israel with him to Libna, which was another key military center, and they fought against Libna. Verse 30, and the Lord also delivered it and its king into the hand of Israel. He struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword. And he left none remain in it, but did so to its king as he had done to the king of Jericho. Okay, so we're talking about Makkedah and Libna, key military centers who are not part of that coalition, but they were taken along with its people and its kings and they were executed. But again, the key here, first part of verse number 30, and the Lord delivered it and its king into the hand of Israel. We can't forget that. God promised that he was going to battle for them, and he did. And you know, this is a lesson for each and every one of us. We all face our battles. I mean, we have them daily. It can be battles with family life. It could be at work. It could be at school. Whatever our battles are, God is there to fight for us. And we need to keep that in mind and always ask him for help when we face our battles. Okay, continuing on now with more of the southern cities that are taken. This section talks about the city of Lachish and Gezer being taken. Verse 31. Then Joshua passed from Libna and all Israel with him to Lachish, which was one of those Canaanite cities that went against Gibeon. And they camped against it and fought against it. And the Lord delivered Lachish into the hand of Israel. There it is again, God's deliverance. Who took it on the second day and struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libna. See, what's not described here is these Canaanite forces. They had the best weapons of the ancient world. And they had the cavalry. They had things that the Israelites did not have. Didn't matter because God was fighting for them, as we continue to see. Verse 33. Then Horam, the king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish. And Joshua struck him and his people until he left none remaining. So Lachish is taken, and all the people in a two-day siege, according to verse 32. And then verse 33 describes the king of Gezer. He tried to help Lachish, but his attack was in vain against Israel, and they lost the battle as well. More Canaanite cities that were taken. Verse 34, the city of Eglon was taken. From Lachish, verse 34, Joshua passed to Eglon, another one of city that fought against Gibeon, and all Israel with him. And they encamped against it and fought against it. They took it that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. All the people who were in it, he utterly destroyed that day, according to all that he had done to Lachish. So this was one of the cities, Eglon, that had been part of the anti-Gibeon coalition. Its king had been executed, one of them that had their foot, they put their foot on his neck and executed him. Now the city is taken as part of its punishment. Verse 36 through 39, Hebron and Debir are taken. Verse 36, so Joshua went up from Eglon, and all Israel with him, to Hebron, and they fought against it. They took it and struck it with the edge of the sword, its king and all its cities, and all the people who were in it. He left none remaining, according to all that he had done to Eglon, but utterly destroyed it, and all the people who were in it. Verse 38, then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him to Debir, and they fought against it. And he took it, verse 39, and its king and all its cities, you know, cities around it that had forces. They struck them with the edge of the sword, and utterly destroyed all the people who were in it. He left none remaining, as he had done to Hebron. So he did to Debir and its king, as he had also done to Libna and its king. So we see again more Canaanite cities that are taken by Israel. Hebron being mentioned, and also Debir, cities that were taken in the southern campaign. The next section that we come to is a summary verse, or a summary section, I should say, which summarizes the conquering of southern Canaan. Verse number 40. So Joshua conquered all the land, the mountain country in the south, and the lowland, and the wilderness slopes, and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God of Israel had commanded. Remember, we read this in Deuteronomy and even back in Leviticus, that these Canaanites were terrible, terrible pagans, and they did corrupt things in their worship. They sacrificed their children to their pagan gods, putting them into the fires. There's just so many horrible things that these people did. And God said that they should be destroyed out of the land so they wouldn't corrupt his people. And that's why they did this in this way. Continuing on, verse 41. And Joshua conquered them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. Verse 42. All these kings and all their land in the south, Joshua took at one time, or in other words, one campaign. And the reason why? Because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal, where they had made their first camp after crossing the river Jordan. So all the land of southern Canaan was conquered, and that's what this section was summarizing. Now there's some names here that might be familiar to all of us. First of all, in verse 41, Kadesh Barnea is mentioned. That's where Israel had first came to when they left Mount Sinai, and they came to the southern part of Canaan, and they sent the spies out to check out the land, the scouts, Numbers 13, 14. When the scouts came back and said, oh, the Canaanites are fierce warriors, they have walled cities, and there's giants in the land. And the people rebelled, and eventually the generation that came out of Egypt, God said, would die in the desert. That was at Kadesh Barnea. Also, you see this term Gaza in verse 41. You hear even that term today, the Gaza Strip, where the Palestinians live, and they fight against the Jews over in the Middle East. This is that section of southwest corner of Canaan, the Gaza Strip. Also, Goshen is mentioned. This is not the Goshen of Egypt, but a region in the southeastern edge of Canaan. And the summary verse here in verse 42 said that all these kings and their land Joshua took at one time or in one campaign. And that emphasizes how quickly it was completed. You know, altogether, most of the commentators and historians feel that this whole Canaanite campaign took 7 years against many, many cities of fortified ancient warriors. And it happened really very, very quickly. And the reason why? Because the Lord God fought for Israel. Okay, that brings us to the end of chapter 10. And again, God's fulfillment of what he would do. Now we come to chapter 11, which is the northern campaign in Canaan. And what we're going to see here is a king in the northern part of Canaan, king of Hazor, who was a very powerful king over a very powerful city, tries to unite all the rest of the northern Canaanite cities in one big, huge army to fight against Israel. That's what takes place in chapter 11. And really, Joshua and his warriors didn't have any time to rest. They had just gone against those cities that were mentioned in chapter 10, fighting against them. Now they've got to go to the north and fight against a huge coalition. Verse number 1. And it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that all of southern Canaan had fallen, that he sent to Jobab, king of Medan, to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Ashaph. Verse 2. And to the kings who were from the north, in the mountains, in the plain of Chinrash, that's an early name for Galilee, which we hear about in the New Testament, the south plain of Chinrash, in the lowland, and in the heights of Dor on the west. Verse 3, to the Canaanites in the east and in the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite in the mountains, and the Hivite below Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So he's getting together all the rest of the Canaanites that are left to form one big mighty coalition against Israel. Verse 4, notice this. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. It was just a huge, huge army that was assembled. Verse 5, and when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. And they camped together to discuss their battle strategy of how they're going to put down these pesky Israelites. Okay, so we see here in verse number 1 that the king of Hazor, he was a mighty king in the north, heard about the defeat of southern Canaan. This was a mighty city, much larger than all the other Canaanite cities. And he arranges to form a coalition against Joshua and Israel. This term in verse number 4, or this phrase, where it says, a huge army, as many as the sand is on the seashore in multitude, and described as having very many horses and chariots, the Hebrew expression of that describes the most fearful fighting machinery available in the ancient world. This was the best equipped army of that day and time that they had brought together. And Josephus, who you've heard that name, he was a first century Jewish historian. He speculated in his writings that there were 300,000 infantry that were assembled by this coalition, and that there was 10,000 cavalry mounted on horses, and that there was 20,000 chariots. That was the huge coalition that Josephus, his figures that had been assembled against Israel. And in verse number 5, they meet at the waters of Merom, which was an ancient road to Hazor, to discuss their battle strategy of how they would fight against Israel. Mighty army that was assembled, but it doesn't matter. We're going to see here in the next section the victory by means of God's hands against this northern coalition. Verse number 6. But the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them. You know, 300,000 men, 20,000 cavalry, you know, chariots or whatever. Don't be afraid. For tomorrow about this time, 24 hours later, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So God said, don't worry about this mighty army. I'll take care of them. Just like he had promised he would do. Now you notice that they're going to hamstring their horses, which that actually means to cut their tendons in a way that they couldn't fight in any more battles, and then burn their chariots with fire. This was to prevent Israel from gathering those horses and chariots together and putting their trust in those forces. Their trust was to be in God, not in chariots and horses and armaments, etc. So they were to burn the chariots with fire and hamstring the horses. Verse 7. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them. And here's the key, verse number 8. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to greater Sidon, to the brook Mizpah, and to the valley of Mizpah eastward. And they attacked them until they left none of them remaining. So again, God was with them, and that's the key to the victory against this mighty force. Verse number 9. So Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses. The King James Version has the term H-O-U-G-H, which means to hamstring them, cut their tendons so that they couldn't be used for battles, and burn their chariots with fire. I've got an interesting comment from the Zondervan Bible backgrounds commentary here about this mighty force. It says, the presence of chariots among the northern coalition suggests a sophistication not found in the south. Here in the north, the leaders had more wealth and power, so they could afford to field the most advanced weaponry of the era. The best weapons that were available in the ancient world didn't matter. And I already mentioned about hamstringing their horses. That was a method used to render them useless for battle, to sever the hamstring. And again, so Israel couldn't get the idea to use them as their forces. One more point I want to make up before we move along here about the horses. Several of the commentaries point out about the horses that the Canaanites actually used them in their pagan worship. They used them in their sun worship ceremonies. And they would parade the horses in their sun worshiping ceremonies. And they would put solar disks on the foreheads of the horses to use them in their sun worship. And so we see another reason why these horses are dealt with here as well. Okay. The key to victory, as I already mentioned, against this mighty force, the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel. And this terminology in verse number 8, from greater Sidon to the brook of Mizpah and to the valley of Mizpah, the Israelite army pursued the coalition around the province of Galilee, which was called Chinnereth in those days, in a clockwise route. And all of the coalition kingdoms were invaded and became a part of Israel's northern territory. Now this king of Hazor, who had united this mighty coalition, is going to be dealt with. Verse number 10. And Joshua turned back at that time and took Hazor, struck its king with the sword. For Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire. There was only three Canaanite cities that Israel burned. Jericho was one, the second one was Ai, and Hazor. They left all the other cities standing so that they could occupy them, because God had told them, the new generation, that you're going to be entering cities that you did not build, and you're going to be having food that you did not grow, and that God would take care of them, in other words. Okay, Hazor was the head of all those kingdoms in the northern coalition. And it was supreme among the cities in what became the province of Galilee, the most important of the northern kingdoms. Here's a couple comments from Tyndale Commentary. It said, Hazor, it was one of the largest Bronze Age tells cities in Palestine. The archaeological evidence of a well-fortified city with international contacts confirms its leading status during the second millennium. So this is just saying that there's archaeological evidence that this Hazor city existed and that it was a mighty center of international contacts, etc. And Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this: Hazor was singled out for special treatment, probably because it was the largest city in ancient Palestine, 200 acres in size. And of course, it was mentioned that it was burned. The next section that we come to now, in verses 12 through 23, is the summary of the whole conquest of Canaan. Verse number 12. So all the cities of those kings and all their kings, Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. But as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them, except Hazor only in the north, which Joshua burned. And that was so that they could occupy them later on. And all the spoil of these cities and of the livestock, the children of Israel, took as booty for themselves. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them and left none breathing. Verse 15, as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone, all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And I already mentioned previously that only Hazor was burned in the north as an example of the organizer of this northern coalition. Okay, we'll continue on now, and we'll go to verses 16 through 23. The summary of the conquest by God's hand. Verse 16. Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands. Verse 17, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Verse 18, Joshua made war a long time with those kings. And actually, there's even some battles that weren't even described in the book of Joshua. Verse number 19. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon, who portrayed themselves as from a faraway country. All the others they took in battle. Verse 40. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that he might have no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. And again, because they were such terrible pagans that did such corrupt and terrible things. It says here in verse number 18 that Joshua made war a long time. And you know, what we've read so far was just part of the campaign, but it's generally thought that the conquest took 7 years altogether. And we see this phrase in verse number 20, for it was the Lord to harden their hearts. New International Commentary of the Old Testament adds this: the stubborn heart is due to God's hardening process. The hardening had for its ultimate purpose the destruction of the Canaanites, who in the light of Genesis 15:16 had become increasingly iniquitous during the period of Israel's sojourn in Egypt. The iniquity of the Amorites, the Canaanites, had reached its full, and thus God had taken it to them. Okay, the summary of all the battles had been described here in this section of Scripture. There's one group of people left that's going to be described, and that's the Anakites, those giants. Remember when the spies, the scouts came back in the book of Numbers and said, there's giants in the land. We'll never be able to take them. That's what's described in the next section, the defeat of the Anakites. Some of them, commentators point out, were 9 feet tall. They were the giants that the spies had located when they went throughout the land of Canaan, back again in Numbers 13 and 14. Verse 21. At that time, Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and all the mountains of Israel, Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. So these 9-foot giants were taken care of. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel. They remained only in Gaza, which is called the Gaza Strip today, in Gath, which you remember, that's where Goliath came from, who David fought against, and in Ashdod. So they destroyed most of them in the land of Israel, except for these three areas. So Joshua, verse 23, took the whole land, according to all the Lord had said to them, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes. Then the land rested from war. Okay, so all the battles had been described previously in chapter 10 and 11, but what had not been talked about was the Anakites, the battle with them, and that's what we just read about. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 1 through 3, God told Israel that the Anakites would be defeated. He said, you're going to conquer, and I'm paraphrasing, you're going to conquer a people great and tall. And that was fulfilled here in what we just read. And this is a fitting conclusion to the conquest of Canaan, these 9-foot. How'd you like to have a 9-foot basketball player on your team? He wouldn't have very far to go to dunk, would he? Anyways, they were defeated. And then verse 23 is a summary of all that had taken place in the land of Canaan and the defeat. This sets us up for chapter 12, which is just a summary chapter, and we're going to go through this very quickly. A summary of where Israel had acquired all of their land. And the first section here in verses 1 through 6 talks about the kings that were defeated east of Jordan. This actually goes back to the book of Numbers when that took place. And it's being reviewed here in the book of Joshua. Verse number 1 of chapter 12, and we'll go through this quickly as we're winding down now. These are the kings of the land whom the children of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed on the other side of Jordan, toward the rising of the sun, from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon, and all the eastern Jordan plain. What had been talked about in the book of Numbers, where they had conquered the land east of Jordan. One king, verse 2, was Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon and ruled half of Gilead, from Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, from the middle of that river as far as the river Jabbok, which is on the eastern border, which is on the border of the Ammonites. Verse 3, in the eastern Jordan plain, from the Sea of Chinnereth, that's an old name for Galilee, as far as the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, what we call the Dead Sea today, the road to Beth Jeshimoth, and southward towards the slope of Pisgah. So this section is describing the defeat of Sihon and the control of part of the eastern side of Jordan that Israel gained. The next section describes more of the defeat on the eastern side of Jordan, the defeat of Og and his territory. Verse 4, the other king was Og, king of Bashan, and his territory, who was remnant of the giants, who dwelt at Ashtaroth at Edrei, and reigned over Mount Hermon, over Salca, and over Bashan, and over the border of the Jeshurites, and the Maacathites, and over half of Gilead to the border of Sihon, king of Heshbon. These Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the children of Israel had conquered, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given it as a possession to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And if you remember back in the book of Numbers, that these three tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh, wanted that territory east of Jordan because it was good for raising cattle. And God gave that area to them. The next section then is a review of what we've just gone through, the kings west of Jordan that were defeated. Verse 7. And all the kings of the country which Joshua and the children of Israel conquered on this side of Jordan, on the west, from Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon as far as Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, which Joshua gave to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their divisions. In the mountain country, in the lowlands, in the Jordan plain, in the slopes, in the wilderness, and in the south, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. So these are names of and a description of the territory west of the Jordan River that Israel had conquered. Now, why is this important to go through all of this where Israel gained this territory? It's important because God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He said, I'm going to give this land to your descendants. And here it's fulfilled. He fought their battles. Now they occupy the land. And then when we come to the next Bible study, chapter 13 through 19, the war is ended and the land begins to be distributed to the tribes. And we'll talk about that the next time. But we've got one more section to deal with here. And I'm not even going to read all of these kings. This is just a list of all the kings that were captured in the land of Canaan. And basically, just to summarize, verses 10 through 16 is a list of the southern kings that were mentioned in chapter 10 that were captured. And verses 17 through 24 is a list of the northern kings mentioned in chapter 11 that were captured. And not mentioned yet is areas where no battle was fought. And that will be discussed in the next chapter, chapter 13, when we talk about the distribution of the land when the war is over. So that brings us to the end of this study, except we'll talk about some lessons that we've learned today, a couple of them anyways. First of all, remember that Joshua and Israel faced overwhelming odds against them in the northern coalition of Canaanites. 300,000 soldiers, 20,000 cavalry. It was a huge, huge force, but it didn't matter. The lesson is that the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them. Chapter 11, verse number 8. And the lesson for all of us, and I mentioned this earlier, put your battles into God's hands. Put your battles into God's hands. Another lesson is God listened to Joshua's prayer and the miracle of the sun and the moon standing still on behalf of his people. The lesson for all of us, James chapter 5, verse 17, the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And we see this in the book of Joshua. Joshua prayed for a miracle, and God performed it. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. We can remember that in our prayers as well. So that's the end of this study, unless anybody has any questions or comments.